So now it's a very special privilege. We are going to have a presentation by Dr. Rod McGinnis, who will present the Scriver Family Lecture. Rod is well known to Montreal and to the children's and to the university. In fact, now, of course, I don't have to tell you about his Toronto history since he's now a Montrealer. He joins us as the ALBA Chair in Human Genetics, and a scientific director at the Lady Davis Research Institute. He is most recently from the University of Toronto, and he's also and continues as the scientific director of the Institute of Genetics and CIHR. So those of you who have a complaint about your grants, here's your chance. There'll be a question period afterwards. Rod did train at McGill, as we've been hearing about many of the scientists here, and he specifically trained with Charles Scriver. I've known Rod since, I'm not exactly sure, either 75 or 76 or so, when he came to SickKids, and we were in adjacent laboratories, so I've had an opportunity to see the development of his research activities over many, many years. He's internationally known for his work on retinal and eye development, but he has a depth of science that reaches far more broadly, and the title of his lecture today illustrates it. It's on synapses, genetics, and prospects for the drug treatment of intellectual disability in humans.
Rod?
Thomas, can you fix it?
Keep longer, yes?
Yeah. So while Thomas is fixing it, you'll be glad to know, first of all, I'll make your day by saying as I noticed the time advancing, I cut my talk down from 55 to 36 slides. I'm very interested in this history of the group that it's been talked about and why it's been brilliant and successful. And, of course, there's really one core reason, and it's leadership. It all begins with people. And Charles and Clark are two of the most, not only the most amazing scientists I know or many of us know, and if any of us begin to achieve about a third of what they've done, then we've done very well. But they're also wonderful human beings. And when I gave a talk to the students this morning, one of the things I hadn't talked about enough, and a couple of them came up and asked me, was what about work-life balance? And I think one of the outstanding characteristics of these two leaders is that they are passionate not only about science, but about life in general. In fact, I find people who are passionate about science are generally passionate about a lot of other things in life, too. How are we doing here?
we're trying to change your resolution.
I don't want to hear about it, Stuart. So Charles, I owe my presence here actually to another son of McGill, Richard Goldblum, who when I was at Dalhousie and finishing medical school, I went to him and I said, I tentatively and very nervously said, I want to be a researcher in genetics. And he said, I'll get back to you. And a week later or two, he called and said, you're going to work with Charles Scriver at McGill. And I said, okay. I was a little guy from Halifax, not from Shawinigan, but from Halifax, and equally intimidated. And the first time I met Charles, we sat in his office for an hour talking about the potential research project. I think I absorbed about three sentences. It was absolutely terrifying, but I got over it with the help of many of the colleagues in the lab who were very warm and wonderful. And I particularly fondly remember Fazil Mayuddin, who was a research associate of Charles that all of us knew and loved. So first of all, they were great leaders and great scientists. Secondly, though, they established a culture of success. And I think that's what those of us who have been successful have been able to transmit to our own trainees. You know, culture is one of these transmitted traits that's not heritable. What did I do to deserve this? Okay. Thank you. Yeah. The last thing I want to say is there's that several of the speakers, former members of the lab or people linked to it, have referred to the warm relationship and sort of family atmosphere. It's almost like a college, you know, the Scriver Fraser College of researchers. And this is the significance of this is indicated by the fact that I don't think Simon, John, and I have spent probably more than 2 hours over the last 20 years talking. Yet we feel, I think, very close to each other and would support each other in almost anything. There's a book on you know how you buy novels and put them in your shelf and never read them. Well, one of the ones I've got like that, and the title of which is People You'd Trust Your Life With. And I think all of us feel that way about former trainees, and we feel an immediate proximity that's hard to kind of explain, but it's all based on this family feeling that Charles and Clark have given us. And so it's particularly nice to be giving the family, the Scriver family lecture on this occasion, and I'm deeply honored, because I think we all feel like we're part of the Scriver family, and I think we all feel we're as close to Zipper almost as we are to Charles and to Charles's progeny. So it's a pleasure to be here talking about science. So the project I'm going to talk about today, the work I'm going to talk about today, is actually unbelievable, the subject, because it would have been unimaginable when I started training, and even 10 years ago, that you can take a mouse and potentially a human, and there's many examples of this now, who has an inherited intellectual defect, and improve or treat the intellectual defect with a drug. So that's what this story is about. So just in case you're not recently acquainted with neurons, although you have them, of course, is that one neuron speaks to another through its axon, and they connect at the synapse, and the recipient, the neuron receiving the signals, receives the signal not through an axon, but another similar-looking structure called a dendrite. And so this is a high-view schematic of this situation, and the axon releases signaling molecules, for example, glutamic acid, glutamate, which drifts across this cleft between the two cells in the synapse. And the glutamate, for example, binds to receptors, often ion channels, and things happen, and the recipient cell learns or unlearns or whatever it's supposed to do. So an overview of what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk briefly about synapses and what we know about them, the fact that there are an increasing number of genetic diseases that affect synapses. I'm going to mention the fact that I'm actually left out autism is one of the slides I deleted, but the fact that autism and schizophrenia have turned out to have a significant fraction of patients have deletions in genes that encode synaptic protein. And this is not surprising. You know, I mean, if you mess up your synapses, I think any of us would have imagined that you might get something like autism and schizophrenia and probably many other psychiatric and mental disorders. And indeed, this is true. And the last thing I'll talk about, of course, as I've indicated, is that synaptic defects can be rescued. So the human brain is, you know, quantitatively, even if you don't even know much about what neurons and synapses do, is rather beyond belief. There's 20 billion neurons and 10 to the 15 synapses in the total brain, it's estimated, that connect these neurons. Okay, so just quantitatively, this is getting into the stuff that Vicky Caspi studies, you know, like astrophysics in terms of the numbers involved. So synapses are the fundamental units of information processing, and they're highly specialized sites of communication. And so the average neuron reaches out and makes 1,000 contacts with another neuron, okay, and receives up to 10,000 contacts from different other neurons. So we're never going to be able to figure out exactly what a single neuron is doing. We're going to be able to understand this in a whole systems biology, current word, but here's a real application of it kind of a way. And a Purkinje cell, which is one of the major cells in the cerebellum that helps you keep balance and so on, is unreal. It receives up to 100,000 contacts. So this is pretty stunning stuff. And Josh Haynes is a major synaptic investigator. He studies the synapses where nerves contact muscles. I thought this was a rather nice quote. It's turned out to be true. When he said it, it wasn't certain about the psychiatric disease. But synapses are the heart and soul of the brain, where thinking and learning occur, and where psychiatric disease may, now we can say, does originate. So what do we know in more detail about the synaptic composition of synapses? It's kind of fuzzy. If you go to different synaptic databases or look at different papers, it's really unclear how many proteins, different in all synapses, how many proteins are there. And in one synapse, we don't know. And there's not a great deal known, I've discovered, there's not a heck of a lot known about synaptic heterogeneity. Not all synapses are the same. I don't even know if they're all the same in a particular region of the brain. So undoubtedly, some people in the audience do. But there's a guess there's about 3,000 different proteins that are can be located in synapses. That doesn't mean they're not also in other places in the body. And about 300 of them at least, okay, that's a minimum estimate, are involved in synaptic structure and function. Another 400 are in this on the receiving side in the dendrite, in the region that contacts that's adjacent to the synaptic cleft, getting signals from the axon, glutamate signals, for example. This region is called the postsynaptic density, and it's given that name because electromicrographically it's dense. And you can actually, it's so dense, there's such a high concentration of proteins there, you can spin it out in a centrifuge, which is convenient. So there's a couple of databases here you may want to refer to, the Synapse database and Genes2 Cognition, kind of a corny name, but anyway. What are some of these proteins? Well, basically, there's three major classes, and this is obviously a gross simplification, but to get you going, there are scaffolding proteins, which you can kind of think of as the superstructure with, you know, like a building with cement and steel rods, and then you hang all the rooms and decorations on it. So scaffolding proteins are the locations on which other multi-protein complexes are assembled. You know, if you want to get subunit A and subunit B together, how do you do that? Well, one way to do it is have a scaffolding protein where subunit A binds to one part of the scaffolding protein and subunit B to another, and now they're close to each other and they can function. So one of the most famous, and the one I'm talking about here, is postsynaptic density protein PSD95, because that's its mass. And it's the scaffolding protein for one of the second classes of molecules, an example of which, and one of the two examples I'll talk about here, called the NMDA receptor. Never mind what NMDA means. It's just a wild chemical that happens to activate this receptor specifically. But this is a glutamate in the brain, and our brain's activated by glutamic acid. There's no such thing as NMDA in us. But this molecule specifically identifies this glutamate receptor. So the NMDA receptor is involved in memory and learning, as you're going to hear more about. And another key receptor that's part of this story and critical to memory and learning is called the AMPA receptor. AMPA is, again, a wild chemical that happens specifically. It's not present in the brain to activate and identify this receptor at a functional level. Okay? And then, so they're scaffolding proteins. There are these various kinds of receptors, and they're called receptors because they receive, for example, glutamate signals across the synaptic cleft. But actually, they're both, these two are ion channels. So as soon as it gets the glutamate signal, it opens and stuff happens. Okay, and we'll talk about the stuff. And then there are structural proteins that sort of help the synapse form in the first place and stay glued together. Once it's formed. An example of those are the neural ligand shown here in Neurexin. Okay, so that's a synapse. So all kinds of studies recently in identifying a class of mutations called copy number variants. And these are deletions which occur in the genome, surprisingly big ones that can be 100 kilobases up to megabases big, and we all have them, and they're one of the major reasons that Abe Fuchs and I are different people, apart from other reasons. And we don't want to go there, though. and so it's been found that there are a number of genes that are involved in schizophrenia that have been identified by classical genetics, but also a very much larger number identified because they affect these copy number variants and have a much higher frequency of association in schizophrenia that affect these proteins involved in axons or synapses or glutamate receptor signaling. And these are some of them, some of the names are shown here. So this is kind of fantastic in several ways. First, you have a genetic cause. But secondly, we really didn't know what was going on in schizophrenia. You know, there's all kinds of wonderful hypotheses. But basically, this, apart from the fact that it's true, that these are not a very common cause of schizophrenia, but they're informative. They tell you that if you mess up the synapse, bad stuff happens. What's fascinating is why it takes sometimes 20 years. You know, why is the age of onset of schizophrenia generally in early adulthood? That's just one of those wonderful mysteries that someday we might be able to solve. So what I'm going to tell you now is about getting into our part of how we got into this area of synaptic genetics. And so the protein I'm going to talk about, which is NETTO1, is a synaptic protein. How we found that, I won't go into detail at all, but it started out as a search for proteins that we thought would be likely to be involved in retinal development. And it turned out it is actually, but a totally minor player, but it's really important for brain development. So we sort of went where the molecule took us in our research. So, and this is really a story of the hippocampus. Okay, so this morning, I couldn't find my way to the Department of Human Genetics on the fifth floor of the Stuart Building, and David, you know, like the, it was just unbelievable. And so David says to me, "Well, you know, you used to be here. You know, like 30 years ago was the last time I was there. And the reason I couldn't find it because the particular cells in my hippocampus, which would be able to place that room." In the Stuart Building, called Place Cells, where, you know, like 35 years ago, they're probably dead. Okay. So the hippocampus is involved in two things, at least. One is short-term memory, but the second is spatial learning and memory. Okay, so like I said, when you walk in here and you localize and you say, "I was in that seat last week, I like it, I'm going to go there," your hippocampus is working. And you can see where the name comes from. You know, there's a nice seahorse from a particular lake in Japan. The nicest picture of a seahorse I could find that most resembled the hippocampus. And so that's a way to hippocampus is Latin for seahorse. So nobody knew really what the hippocampus did until Brenda Milner, who is the major researcher described here and referred to in this article in The Globe, began to study this gentleman named Henri Moleson, who died last year, who at the age of 19 had a motorcycle accident and hurt his head and developed intractable seizures. And so not much was known about, you know, what caused the seizures or what would happen if you did neurosurgery in certain parts of the brain, but in any case, the seizure locus was thought to be the hippocampus, and so it was removed. And he immediately lost any memory except for even if something 5 minutes ago. Okay, long-term memory, he had a very good long-term memory. So as described here, he knew his name. This is after the age of 19, okay, when, say, 30 or 40 or 50. That much he could remember. He knew that his father's family came from Thibodaux, Louisiana. His mother was from Ireland. And he knew about the 1929 stock market crash, which predated his accident, and the Second World War, and about life in the 1940s. But he could remember almost nothing after that. Okay, so this was not an experiment of nature, but an experiment of medicine, unfortunately, that told us what the hippocampus was really required for. And so I want to take the time to play this movie, because I think it's quite... there we go. Are we hooked up for time?
So I said to him, "I want you to remember the number 584. And then I had a cup of coffee with Dr. Scoville's secretary, whom I cannot picture now. And 20 minutes later, I went back into the office and I said, "Now, do you remember the number?" And I expected him to look at me blankly, and he said, 584. I was really absolutely astonished. I was extremely naive in those days, but we all were.
Why is it in there? Well, I don't know what's happened. It plays usually very well. But in any case, what she says is, you know, she came back into the office, and he actually remembered the number 584, and he had developed some completely baroque architectural method for remembering 584 that, you know, had nothing to do with normal memory at all. This was just a sort of acute part of this whole story. I apologize for it not working fully. Anyway, this protein, NETTO1, that I referred to, that's going to be the subject of what I'm going to tell you now. We published a paper in PLOS Biology some months ago, and if you want to get the pre-digested version of it, it was actually reviewed in this Clinical Implications of Basic Research in the New England Journal of Medicine in July. It's got 26 figures, so you might want to start with the New England Journal one if you're interested in this. But the point is, so it's a novel cubdomain proteins. Cubdomains are external structures that are about 100 amino acids long that interact with other proteins. Okay, common kind of thing. And what we found is two things, at least. One is that part of this NMDA receptor, this ion channel that's required for learning and memory in the brain. And secondly, we found that we could correct the learning defect with the drug. So here's a picture of the synapse and these two receptors in it. And so the NMDA receptor, we found that NETA1 was part of the NMDA receptors. And in the absence of NETA1, the number of NMDA receptors containing NR2A subunits was reduced about 50%, okay, for those of you who are aficionados of this. So there were less NMDA receptors in the synapses, in the hippocampus, of brains without this accessory protein, conjunction protein, for example, called NETA1. And what we've done in treating these animals is we haven't done anything with the mutant protein. In fact, it's a protein null. You could put the protein back, of course, but the gene. But we haven't done anything to improve the function directly by attacking pharmacologically the NMDA receptor. What we did was we increased the activity of this other receptor, this AMPA receptor I referred to, and when you do that, it had a beneficial effect on the main focus of our attention, the NMDA receptor. So NETA1 is a component of the NMDA receptor we showed. We showed that mutations in these mice impair synaptic strength, okay, and impair learning, spatial learning and memory in mice, and that these defects are rescued by this drug called an ampakine because it activates the AMPA receptor, okay? So the mutant, just to emphasize, the mutant ion channel receptor is the AMPA receptor, but the treated one, whose activity we increased, is the other one. So in more detail, here's the story. So the NMDA, so NETA1 is a component of a complex of proteins that congregate around the NMDA receptor, and there's at least 100, thought to be about 100 proteins that form this protein complex around the four core subunits called NR1, NR2, and so on. And so we found that, and we wondered, does it matter? And normally what happens is, as I say, that when you activate this ion channel, calcium flows into the recipient, the neuron being talked to, and initiate signaling processes and establish this, in this case, memory. And if you knock out, if you get rid of the NMDA receptor, you nearly obliterate any spatial learning and memory. Okay, so it's the same thing almost as not having a hippocampus at all. So if you knock out NETA1, you decrease the number of NMDA receptors at the synapse, as I said, and you get decreased synaptic efficacy. The ability of these synapses to function is reduced. There's not only fewer of them, but they don't function as well, we think. There's decreased spatial learning and memory. We threw in an ampakine into these mice, and we rescued synaptic efficacy as measured by physiological studies, sticking needles in brain slices. And we improved in the whole animals their ability to, in fact, we restored to normal their spatial learning and memory. You'll be glad to know why ethanol is so interesting and is such a pleasant experience, is that it actually messes up the function of the NMDA receptor. So there's your pharmacology of the day. So I've referred to this is the protein NETA1. There's another protein, NETA2, that we're also working on, and they're both multifunctional. They're involved in axon guidance. They're not involved in other kinds of ion channels, non-synaptic, and we have evidence they're involved in. There are components of several other synaptic proteins as well, but I'm not going to talk about that. If any of you are interested, I'd be happy to tell you. So they have these two cubdomains outside, and that's when they interact with another protein, including the NMDA receptor, it's through these cubdomains. Okay? And we gave just for your interest, where's the name come from? The name came from the fact that the proteins in nature which had the most similar cubdomains to this new one we discovered were an axon guidance molecule called neuropilin and another patterning molecule in flies called toloid, so we called it NETA. And in fact, the similarity to this molecule led us to go on and study axon guidance defects in these knockout mice, and they're very much there, but that's another thing. So we found this molecule. It was almost neurospecific. The first question, there's lots of it there. The question is, where in the brain was it? So you do in situ hybridization or immunofluorescence, and this shows you the NETO1 messenger RNA in situ signal, which gives you, which is virtually like drawing a picture of the hippocampus. There's a great deal of it there. And so that made us think it's doing something important, and to leave out 20 figures, what we did was establish, as I've indicated, that it's part of the NMDA receptor. So just to remind you, glutamate, the little red balls, come across the synaptic cleft and bind to these two receptors. And when it binds and activates, opens the AMPA receptor ion channel, sodium enters the neuron. And the AMPA receptor is very much involved in sort of basal synaptic transmission, to say this in an extremely simplistic way. Probably the neurophysiologists in the room are cringing, but anyway. And then glutamate, when it activates the NMDA receptor, you get an increase of sodium, but more uniquely calcium ion inflow. And you through the signaling processes I'm not talking about, you get an increase in synaptic strength or efficacy. Okay. So here's one. I'm not showing much data. I'm just giving you a high-level picture. But here's one picture. If you look at this part of the brain, NMDA receptors, which you can see by quantified by these puncta here, these dots, are a lot less dense, even though the light is making it seem less dense than it is. But the number of these receptors is very much reduced. In fact, about 50% when you're lacking this accessory protein NETO1. Compared to wild-type animals. Okay, so this is a very reproducible, highly significant result. So the question is, so we had this protein, NETO1. It was located in the hippocampus. It's part of the NMDA receptor. Does the brain care? So, I'm a geneticist. What you do if you're a geneticist is you mess things up to find out if it matters. Now, first of all, if with respect to NMDA receptors themselves, if you knock them out, as I've indicated, just like if you ablate the hippocampus, you ablate spatial learning and memory. And so we wanted to study spatial learning and memory in the brains of these NETO1 mice to see whether it affected the function of the NMDA receptor. So at this point, we forged a fabulous collaboration with a wonderful neurophysiologist at SickKids, Michael Salter, who's become a great friend, and we're continuing to work together. And they stick needles in brain slices and measure, they stimulate the neurons and measure the effect on the neuronal tract elsewhere in the brain. And so that's a measure of, to be very simplistic, synaptic efficacy or synaptic strength, okay? Just leaving out all the details. So you can have a basal level of synaptic efficacy, and then you can stimulate the neurons, and you get an increase in this in wild-type animals. If you lack NETO1, so this is a measure of NMDA receptor function. Okay, if you lack NETO1, it's about half normal. So you impair at the physiological level the synaptic efficacy in these mutant mice. Okay, well, that's a physiological study. Does it matter for the mouse's cognitive functional brain? Okay, and so what we did all kinds of neurological tests, but one of the commonly used ones, and there's different ways to use it, is the Morris water maze, where basically you take a cloudy water bath, and around the bath there are a number of big colored symbols, okay, which a mouse, or symbols a mouse can recognize. So on the left there's a round one that's dark, and straight ahead is a white one that's a triangle, etc. And so first you have an entrainment period where you drop the mouse in the water with a visible water bath, and he or she learns to swim to the platform because they hate water and climb out. And then you hide the platform, and they learn to swim around and find the hidden platform. And then you start moving the platform around to different places and see how clever they are in finding the new location. So and they're using these spatial cues, because the platform's hidden, in the environment around to help them find the thing faster and faster once they found the new location, to find it the next time they're tested. Okay, so that's basically how this works. So first thing, you do a pre-trial period where you just have the mouse swim to the visible platform, and that does two things. Your mutant mouse here and the wild-type mice both can see the platform, and they can get there. Their muscular function is good, so they're as good as wild type. So you're not, the test is not being interfered with because they can't see or because they can't swim. And then you have an acquisition phase, which means you train the mice to swim to the platform hidden in a particular location. So here it's in the lower right-hand corner. So over 6 days, you give the mice a number of trials in each time, each day, and it was each day. See, they're not very smart. By the way, rats are massively smarter. Okay, rats can do this, I don't know how many times faster, but in fact, I asked a postdoc to look this up, but I can't remember the answer. But they do it. Rats do it much faster than mice. Okay, so mice learn, although not you know, so they do it about, they find it about twice as quickly after 6 days of training. So we were disappointed, of course, because we didn't see any difference between the wild type and mutant mice after this, after the initial training period. The mutant mice were just as good. But the neurophysiologists or the cognitive guys are more sophisticated. So then what they do is they move the platform and do other kinds of tricks, but this is one of them, to a new hidden location. And here the men and the boys are really separated, because you can see that the Netto 1 mutant in this context virtually couldn't adjust at all to the fact the platform was in a new hidden place, whereas the wild type mouse did this quite well. And we did this in two cohorts of mice, and you know, I think it's a quite a believable result. And there are other mutants in other synaptic proteins that do the same kind of thing. So this was a subtle but definite learning defect. Now, you've got to be careful in a situation like this not to be too anthropocentric interpreting what this means, okay? What it means is that there's a learning defect. You might say, well, is it just because the mutant mice can't forget, you know, has an inability to extinguish the memory of the lower right-hand corner and keeps going there or somewhere else? Well, you can actually look at that by quantifying the amount of time the mouse spends in each quadrant, and the answer is that isn't the answer, okay? The answer to the mouse ability to do this is that he used different strategies but equally effectively to find the hidden platform on the first time, but not the second time. He couldn't cope with it, okay? So, bottom line, these mice have impaired spatial learning and memory. It's rather subtle. Now, it's actually good it's kind of subtle. If it was a total wipeout in spatial learning and memory, the chance you'd be able to do anything about it would be zip. But whereas when we recognize we had a hypomorph here, okay, a cognitive hypomorph, then the thought occurs, maybe I can do something to put this back to normal. And so we knew about these molecules called ampicines, which are developed in California by a company, I will think of it in a minute, Cortex, good name, to improve memory and learning to treat Alzheimer's disease, okay? And so one of these molecules that's come into common use in the lab is this one, this particular ampicine, CX546, which is an allosteric activator of the AMPA receptor. So allosteric in the same way that Mark Trefiro talked about the allosteric changes in the structure of the androgen receptor as things happen. See, Mark, I was listening. Well, he's in my institute. I have to listen. No, it was a great talk. I referred to a kind of a relationship between these two ion channel receptors, and the relationship is this: that the AMPA receptor first opens upon activation with glutamate. And if it doesn't, you can't. The NMDA receptor won't open. And the reason is that it'll be blocked by a magnesium ion that's sitting here and blocking the pore, okay? But if the AMPA receptor opens and increases the positive charge inside the cell, that increased internal intracellular net positive charge expels the potassium ion out of the pore and now opens this pore to the inflow of sodium and calcium. Okay, so there's an interdependence between these two things. So what's happening with the ampicine then is it actually keeps the AMPA receptor open. It sustains the opening. So that means it sustains the increase in positive charge inside the cell, and we thought that would be likely. In fact, that's why the drug was developed. But in our case, we thought it would be likely to, might overcome the loss of function or the decreased function in the NMDA receptor by keeping the NMDA receptor open longer and compensating for this decreased function that it had as a result of the loss of NETO1. And the answer is yes, that's what happens, okay? So here's an electrophysiological measure of synaptic strength. Okay, so here's the basal level. It's the same in wild type and mutant mice, and the cohort of mutant mice that were eventually treated. And here's the NETA1 knockouts. This is not the same data as before, but it's the same result, about 50% of the previous level compared to the wild type up here. But here you can see that in the wild type animal, given the drug, we gave a dose of the drug that had no effect. Okay, I mean, you could obviously, you can increase this, the efficacy of the synapse by giving the drug to a normal brain. They wouldn't learn anything by doing that. So we found a dose of the drug that had no effect on the wild-type synaptic efficacy, but restored the function, the synaptic efficacy of the NETA1 knockout animals, NMD receptor, to normal, okay, with this particular dose of the drug. So that was encouraging, but that's nice. Does it matter? You know, same question. Does this have effects on learning? And the answer is it's one of these things you don't quite believe. It's so lovely. So this is a different experiment showing the same kind of thing that initially the wild type and mutants, when you're teaching them how to find this hidden platform, they're indistinguishable. Then you move the platform, and the mutant mice, better than the previous cohort, but certainly much less better than normal. But when you add this ampicine CX546 to the knockout mice, they now have an ability to find the hidden platform that's the same as the wild type. Okay. So you might say, well, does that matter? This is all very nice, mice. But who would give a drug like this to a human? You might dement them or give them schizophrenia or God knows what. But in fact, Gary Lynch, who's the founder of Cortex and who identified this class of chemicals, published this paper. And I notice it's 1997, but what happened is he then went, he found this and he went and started the company. He figured he's on to something good. Maybe, hopefully he is, right? And so you can enhance, I can't imagine the human ethics groups reviewing this study, okay? Like, things aren't that different 1997 to now, but anyway, here you go. So in a cohort of normal individuals using memory tests that you can do, it was found that the administration of small amounts of this drug had this beneficial effect on memory. And this is in this journal, Experimental Neurology, 1997, if you want to go read it. So this is an example of what really is an unbelievable paradigm shift in neuroscience and in neurology. And the paradigm shift is this. You know, I think we all used to think, and I used to think till we got into this stuff, that if a person has an intellectual defect, whether it's acquired or genetic, but particularly if it's genetic, that's it. They're sort of locked into that state for life. Yes, you can read things like, and it is true to some extent, the best quote I could find was in this very wonderful authority, the Merck Manual, but it's nevertheless true, that all children with mental retardation, this is about an 8-year-old edition, all children with mental retardation / intellectual disability benefit from special education. But that's like damning with faint praise. It's not really, you're helping them, but it's not really what you'd like to do. So what this mouse thing that I've told you about in other examples, and I'll show you one of them in the interest of time, there's about 8 examples of mice who have been made, generated with genetic mutations in the same genes that affect humans, in which their learning defect, impairment, has been improved by drugs which act at the pathways that are disturbed in those mutants. Okay, so one example is in a mouse model, and this is actually testable, as I'll show you, in humans, for this autosomal dominant disease called tuberous sclerosis, which gives you all kinds of phenotypes, and as noted here, these facial angiomas, brain tumors, and tumors in the kidney and heart, and as well as intellectual disability. And the intellectual disability is not due to the tumors. It's due to some biochemical, physiological dysfunction. And so in this mouse model that was generated a few years ago in last year and described in Nature Medicine, these mice, so these, this is a dominant disease, so these mice are a good model of this. In these mice, there was found to be hyperactive signaling of a pathway called mTOR signaling. Don't worry about what it is. Just this particular pathway, which is known to have an effect on memory and learning. was found to be hyperactive in these mice, and that led to decreased synaptic efficacy, spatial learning, and abnormal behavior. Okay, and they could decrease mTOR signaling by giving a drug called rapamycin, which is actually used in people, as I'll show you in a second, for other things, which restored all these things that were adversely affected back to normal. Okay, now this is incredible, and the reason this particular example is particularly incredible is because rapamycin is used in humans with tuberous sclerosis, the subset of them who develop, have a much higher frequency than normal of a particular kind of tumor called a subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, which is a very ugly tumor. But you can see here the response to rapamycin in a human with tuberous sclerosis is indicated here by the shrinkage in the size of the tumor. So when I presented this work to SickKids about 6 months ago, the neurologist or the oncologist looking after these patients ran up and said, all excited, and said, you know, we've got to do testing on these patients to see what happens. And so I think that's underway. But what I like about this example, maybe it won't turn out to be true in the long term, whatever, but it shows there are drugs that can positively affect learning as a principle. It establishes that. In people with genetic intellectual disabilities. This is remarkable. So, what's the substrate here? I mean, how many diseases could we be talking about that you might be able to ameliorate with a strategy like this, genetic or non-genetic? You might improve the neurological function or not, I don't know, but it's worth looking into, of somebody who's got a non-genetic cause of intellectual disability, right? You know, they had a perinatal hypoxia or something. But anyway, so intellectual disability affects 1 to 3% of the population, a pretty remarkable figure. In catalog of human single gene defects, which is called OMIM, about 30% of the 6,000 single gene disorders are associated with intellectual disability. This is not too surprising given the fact that most genes are, a huge fraction of all genes are expressed in the brain. Okay. And so that's a lot of intellectual disability. How many of them are likely to be synaptic, which is the focal point of what I've been talking about? And so there's one study. I realized I took out the source of this, so I apologize for that. But anyway, mutations in synaptic genes appear to account for about 50% of non-syndromic retardation, non-syndromic mental retardation. So about 18 out of 34 genes, non-syndromic retardation, encode synaptic proteins. All right. So given the fact there's up to 3,000 proteins that can be in synapses, the number of single gene diseases that might be that are synaptic might be absolutely huge. And concordant with that, there's studies going back by neuropathologists decades who did amazingly careful observational studies on neurons in the cortex of people with mental retardation and not. And one of the common findings was a decrease in dendritic density, fewer dendrites, okay, dendritic spikes. So maybe you can improve the function of the remaining dendrites. So how common is this? Just almost near the end. So we published the paper in PLOS Biology, and this wonderful student/postdoc who did it all, David Inger, did most of it. We thought, you know, what a great opportunity to write a review article, as we knew about these 7 or 8 other examples. And we picked up literally 2 days after his paper was accepted in PLOS, and he was sitting down to start writing the review. This wonderful review came out in Neuron by Dan Eninger and colleagues from UCLA. And I actually recommend it. If you work in this field, this is a great paper. And so here's one of their statements. Surprisingly, a number of recent animal model studies of neurodevelopmental disorders demonstrate that reversing the underlying molecular deficits can result in substantial improvements in function, even, and this is key, even if the treatments are started in adulthood. That's what's another particularly striking fact. So great review. So these genes, NETO1 and 2, and I would say 80% of the work I presented were done by just an amazing graduate student who then, while I was waiting for his wife, he married one of my other students, for her to finish her PhD. He stayed on as a postdoc in my lab and Mike Salter's lab together, David Ng, and so he's the key player of this, just a wonderful human being and scientist. In fact, it was really cute. A year ago Christmas, about December 23rd, he and his wife come to my door, and they were just off to Columbia. He's now in Tom Jessel's lab. And they come to my door with two bound PhD theses and a baby. So this is a pretty productive couple in the lab. The other person I want to mention, these are all wonderful people who worked on this, but Mike Salter is just a wonderful human being and a great neurophysiologist, and we had a great time working together, and all these others have contributed to various parts of the Netto project. So thank you very much.
Take a few moments for questions.
Please, no questions. There's wine out there.
Compounds known that might stabilize the NMDA receptors? Is it known why you just lose half of them and why some of them seem to be stable when you don't have another one?
Well, not all. Like my total knowledge of synaptic biology is focused around this paper, so even somebody else can answer the question better. But there are different types of NMDA receptors depending on the subunit composition. So maybe ones that contain less of NR2A, which is the molecule that NETTO1 likes in particular, may not be affected by its absence, for example. But we don't know that. No, that's so. Morag is asking a good question. I've left out oceans of data. So there is less, as I showed you, there are less of NR2A containing NMDA receptors at the synapse, fewer puncta. Remember that slide? So the question is does the protein complex not get there, or is it not stable? And we don't know. And you know, thank God the journal didn't push us. It was the one thing we hadn't done. This is like 8 years of work. Okay? And so they didn't push us to do this. It would have taken another 3 or 4 months, so I don't know. But it's one of the two. Yeah, that's a great question. So these accessory proteins for synaptic complexes are often involved, the few that are known, in delivery of the complex to the synapse or keeping it there. It's a good question. I don't know about the NMDA receptor, but certainly if you had missense mutations in the AMPA receptor, and the AMPA kinds are allosteric modifiers of it, they bind at one site, not at the glutamate binding site, they bind somewhere else, the opposite would be unbelievable. It would be kind of unexpected if some missense mutations in the AMPA kind, in the AMPA receptor, were not amenable to treatment by an AMPA kind, not because you're keeping it open longer, but because you're stabilizing the best conformation. It's an interesting point. Yes?
There are a number of chronic monogenic neuronal migration disorders.
Is it possible that some of these would respond to a similar...
Yeah, Eva's asking, is it possible monogenic neural migration or axon guidance defects would respond to these things? I mean, maybe. If you have fewer neurons, even if they have fewer functional synapses, you might be able to enhance the function of the ones, the cells and the synapses are there with a treatment like this. So that could be a non-specific application of a pharmacology like this. What I thought you were going to ask is I alluded to the fact that these mice have axon guidance defects. But actually in the adult, it's amazing. They're virtually invisible and identify only a tiny fraction of cells. And so we're working with Mark Tessier-Levine, and we've gone beyond that now, and we're dissecting the biochemistry of the axon guidance defects. But when you talk to these developmental biologists who work on axon guidance, they've almost, to a person, never looked at the adult. You know, they're developmentalists. Who cares about the adult? And so very frequently, axon guidance, as you can imagine, isn't critical to wiring a normal brain. So there's the biochemical mechanisms that mediate it are incredibly redundant. And so you can see a complete blockage of axon guidance at some particular stage of development, which by the time the animal's an adult is completely overcome. It's stunning. So that's why the axon, we couldn't identify any axon guidance defects in these animals, the cohorts we worked with. Yes, in the adult, yeah.
Do you think that it would be applicable for in people that have any kind of brain damage, just not genetic, like maybe...
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, who knows, eh? I mean, like I said, it doesn't need to be specific. Here, the therapy was very, it wasn't acting on the mutant protein or even the mutant protein complex, but it was a specific therapy acting on a network of proteins. But why not? You know, I just don't know. This is an interesting and important question. And if this, so I left out a slide which said that another ampicline, which has no known side effects, is now in phase two clinical trials for Alzheimer's. Okay, so it got through phase one. That means it didn't do horrible things at low doses, and now it's higher doses. And I don't know what the outcome of that is. You go to the website of the company. You know, clinical trials being run by companies, it's hard to find out what's happened, as you may have discovered. And so it's unclear here. Hopefully someday we'll find out, and hopefully it works. I don't know. So if it works in Alzheimer's, there's a non-specific just cell loss. Now, you know, again, the ethics issues involved in treating children or something like this are pretty daunting. You know, a developing brain is not the same as a mature brain, and activity at the synapse can actually, the activation, affect the formation of synapses and the stability of them. So it's going to be a brave soul who goes there first, but I hope somebody does. And it's harmful, harmless.
Okay, we're going to stop here.
Yep.
I'd like to thank Rod for a tremendously engaging presentation, and I think he illustrates very nicely Clark's reasons why we should be funding ideas and where our experiments take us. The depth that he demonstrates with his science is fabulous.